On the subject of Iraq, knowing what we know now, would you have authorized the invasion?
Every time people pose the question that way, they conceal the real history of the Iraq War.
The media's big question on the Iraq War isn't just dumb, it's dangerous. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Also, a reporter marking the anniversary of a bombing in Philadelphia finds another gap in our collective memory.
This story is frankly insane, right? I mean, it is the kind of thing that should have changed something, but nothing changed at all.
And in the age of the Internet of Things, when you buy something, do you really own it?
They're saying that, you know, you might pirate the software on the tractor. The software comes with the tractor.
There's more coming up. Stay tuned.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The media's big question of the past 2 weeks, one that's sure to dog the candidates on the way to 2016, looks back to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Here's Fox's Megyn Kelly.
Knowing what we know now, would you have authorized the invasion?
The ultimate softball, right? And yet somehow, faced with hindsight questions on Iraq four times last week, Jeb Bush flailed four times, starting at yes and ending at no. And not just Jeb. Here's Marco Rubio with Fox's Chris Wallace.
Knowing everything, as we sit here in 2015.
But that's not the way presidents don't. A president cannot make a decision on what someone might know in the future.
But that's what I'm asking you. Was it a mistake?
It was not a mistake for the president to go into Iraq based on the information he was provided as president.
Recently, such presidential hopefuls and would-be hopefuls as Ted Cruz, Scott Walker, Chris Christie, and John Kasich all agreed that, knowing what we know now, they wouldn't have gone in. So, good for them. They passed that test. But it doesn't matter anyway, because the question itself is a fail. James Fallows recently took on the issue in The Atlantic.
Every time people pose the question that way, as if it was a matter of just what the balance of evidence had been, they conceal the real history of the Iraq War, which was there was a drive to war way before there was any public discussion of the WMD, and the WMD became an excuse for something that was going to happen anyway.
A pretext, as Paul Krugman wrote in his column this week, and you've reported that the war itself was predetermined.
There are people who argue that the security team that was around George W. Bush had thought that there was a non-closed loop in the war against Saddam Hussein back during the first Gulf War in 1991, that the effort to expunge this ultimate source of terrorism, in their view, would not be complete until regime change came to Iraq. What is absolutely certain is that within a day or two of the 9/11 attacks, there were discussions within the administration saying, we don't know where this came from, but we know that the answer has to involve Iraq. What happened in the middle of 2002 and late 2002 was this background concern about Iraq suddenly being elevated to the status of imminent national security threat. You had a Condoleezza Rice with her, you don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Dick Cheney with his famous speech saying that we know for certain Saddam Hussein was building these weapons. But it rose to prominence only after the troops were already moving, the plans were already drawn up for an invasion of Iraq.
So, if you knew then what we know now, it's a terrible question. Let's get to some better ones. You've suggested two.
Yes, and the first one would be very just for the record, matter of fact. If you think back of sort of the moments of decision in late 2002, early 2003, please tell us, Mr. or Madam candidate, how you assessed the evidence and where you came out, just so we have a starting point of what you thought. The real question is the next one. Tell us what you have learned from this experience, your own experience of assessing the information, the nation's experience in going to war, and how your knowledge will shape the assumptions you bring to the next commitment of force, how you think about the efficacy of military force in this part of the world, the lessons you have learned.
That question is very close to one former Defense Secretary Robert Gates asked WNYC's Brian Lehrer this week.
The question that has value is, what lessons should we learn from our experience in going into Iraq in the first place, the mistakes that were made there? What do we take away from that in terms of, for example, the limitations on our ability to shape events in this region?
Well, but I hadn't heard that quote until this second. It's as if I had internalized it. Secretary Gates makes the point better than I have in this past minute, that we can't change the past, we can affect the future, and let's hear what our leaders have taken from it.
Why do you think so many interviewers seem to resort to asking the lousy if we knew then question?
Journalists are less expert on any given topic than the people they're speaking with, usually. These are easier questions to ask without knowing a lot about the circumstances than some other questions.
What worries me the most about posing the question this way, on the basis that we went into war because of bad intelligence, that it seems to let the press off the hook for stating what we do know, and it lets the political establishment off the hook from engaging with the questions of the real lessons of that war. It's actually not just uninformative, but it's counterinformative.
Yes and yes. The next step I would take it is that after the last big bad experience the U.S. had militarily, after the Vietnam War, there was, in my view, accountability. The press went through some examinations about what it had reported right or wrong. Certainly the military went through a prolonged and agonizing examination about how they had done so poorly. Lyndon Johnson was only the most prominent of the people who were punished politically for having gotten us into Vietnam. It's very hard to see signs of a comparably thorough exercise of accountability for the wars of the past dozen years, which were partly bad intelligence, but mainly other things. And so I think, probably not intentionally, but the press's posing of this question is part of the ongoing aversion to accountability, saying we should learn about that, but also recognize specific people making specific mistakes.
So is the bright side of this kerfuffle over a bad question that at least it has us going back over Iraq?
I think that if the controversy began and ended with whether Jeb Bush made a mistake, whether Marco Rubio made a gaffe, then the whole episode would be a net significant minus for the collective IQ. If it might be the beginning of actually dealing with what the United States has done for the last dozen years militarily, perhaps this episode that began as a gaffe could become a positive exercise.
Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic. Before you can learn from the past, you have to remember it. For instance, the president was in Camden, New Jersey this week to unveil a plan to improve police-community relations in part by limiting the use of military hardware.
You know, we've seen how militarized gear can sometimes give people a feeling like there's an occupying force as opposed to a force that's part of the community that's protecting them and serving them.
Now, here's the part about remembering and learning. Just across the river from Camden is Philadelphia, which offered a powerful object lesson 30 years ago this month that hardly anyone remembers.
It sounds automatic fire, Steve. There's quite a bit of it.
A radical group called MOVE, with a history of antagonizing neighbors and clashing with police, defied arrest warrants, and the police went in.
There's more gunfire right now. We're going to crouch down.
Police are unloading Winchester cartridge shells from the back of a highway patrol car.
MOVE had fortified a row house, and when a firefight didn't displace them, police dropped an incendiary device on the bunker constructed on the roof.
State police helicopter drops it. There is the explosion. As you can see, a very dramatic explosion that really rips into the MOVE compound.
Some of these homes will start burning.
You're telling me that the homes on the other side of Osage Avenue may be on fire?
That's correct. There's white smoke coming.
11 people died in that bombing, five of whom were children. The fire that spread destroyed 61 homes, scarring the block to this day. NPR correspondent Gene Demby is a native Philadelphian, and he reported on the 30th anniversary of the bombing. But the response to his reporting shocked him, because many people said they'd never even heard of it.
Yeah, I assumed that a lot of people would just jump in and be like, oh yeah, I remember when this happened. But we got the opposite response, like, wait, this happened?
So the people who said this happened, were they all from out of town or what?
I mean, it was hard to tell. Some people were from Philly and some people seemed to be from elsewhere, but there was no obvious generational skew. I mean, it just seemed to be like this broad base. When did this happen? How did I not hear about this?
It wasn't just white people who were telling you this.
No, I mean, there were quite a few people of color who said that they hadn't heard of it either, which surprised me. But then as the days went on, I guess I stopped being surprised at how many people hadn't heard of it. I'm a Philadelphia native. I would have been 4 when this happened. And it wasn't something that was really discussed in Philadelphia, in part because as extreme as it was, there weren't a lot of ramifications for the city officials who were involved in it. And, you know, nothing changed all that much. No one went to jail. No one suffered any sort of long-term consequences. It was a cataclysm almost without consequence.
Do you know how it was covered at the time?
It was national news as it was happening. I mean, the Times covered it, but it didn't seem to have a very long tail.
How was MOVE characterized?
The Times called them a black radical group. Other people called them a black nationalist group. Ramona Africa, who's the only surviving member of MOVE, told me that she did not agree with the black nationalist label. One, they weren't nationalists, but two, they were actually founded by John Africa, who was black, but a Penn student who was white.
Was a co-founder?
Yeah, he helped germinate the early muddy tenets of MOVE. But she did say that they were revolutionaries.
I'm wondering what your prevailing theory is for why this didn't stick in the public mind. The long tail consequences, obviously, is one point. But I know that you reckon it was the nature of the group of MOVE that created a notable lack of alliances to keep this story alive. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, in the neighborhood that MOVE settled into in the early 80s, it was a pretty middle-class black neighborhood. MOVE actively antagonized the people in that block. I mean, they put megaphones on their compound, which was really just a fortified row house. And they just really, really got under the skin of their neighbors. They just cursed at the residents as they walked by. One Daily News reporter who was covering MOVE at the time said that MOVE very vocally broke up a very hard-won gang truce. There was a meeting between two rival gangs in West Philadelphia, and MOVE sort of came in and started yelling.
What did they want?
Oh, it's really hard to figure out what their specific political aims were. But this is what MOVE wanted on this block. In 1978, in another neighborhood in West Philadelphia, they had this really ugly standoff with the police. And a police officer named Jim Ramp died in that standoff. Several MOVE members, 9 of them, in fact, were convicted in that shooting. So MOVE relocated to 62nd and Osage, which is where this climactic conflagration happened. And what they wanted is not very linear. I mean, they wanted to lean on the residents of 62nd and Osage. They wanted to make life so unbearable that the residents of 62nd and Osage would then presumably lean on the city officials, who would then presumably lean on state officials to have the MOVE non-release from state prison. It's a very long view kind of strategy. And so there was this big sense, even among black community groups and black radical groups, that MOVE was a problem and a nuisance.
For instance, Bobby Seale, a prominent Black Panther, was not a fan of MOVE.
Yeah, Lynn Washington, who was the Daily News reporter that I spoke to, told me about a conversation he'd had with Bobby Seale. And Bobby Seale told him, how can you be a black revolutionary group if you're plotting revolution against black people?
Now, part of the reason why MOVE doesn't stick in the mind the way that, say, Ruby Ridge or Waco does is because this wasn't a standoff between the feds and radical groups. This was a standoff between local police and radical groups.
Yeah, that's right. Ruby Ridge and Waco and the Montana Freedmen standoffs, those could be folded into a larger conversation about gun rights and about federal overreach. We forget that in big cities, the police make up their own political class. They are a constituency unto themselves. And so it makes it harder for local officials to sort of drill down or to wag their fingers too pointedly at the police, especially then when there were a lot of concerns about urban violence, because the police tended to enjoy widespread respect, at least outside of, you know, communities of color. And, you know, as we see now, when there are big controversies over aggressive policing in black communities, there often aren't repercussions, in part because of the politics of it.
Do you think it's even possible, Gene, to take a story that didn't fit into an established narrative when it happened and transport it 30 years into the future in the sense and fit it into the current narrative? You know what I mean?
You know, that's honestly kind of what we were trying to do, I think. We were trying to sort of tease out all the resonances you can see in the MOVE story to this story, this meta story of policing and Black folks that we've been covering over the last year, like what happened in Baltimore last month or what happened to Michael Brown in Ferguson. And it's not neat because the MOVE story sort of resists comprehension, right? I mean, it's the same story we see, but the volume is turned all the way up.
Yeah, the burning of an entire neighborhood and the death of 11 juxtaposed against the death of a single man. Not that one is worthless, but they would tend to generate different coverage.
Absolutely. If this happened today, there would be people with cell phones out watching these houses burn. There would be people nearby watching the police shoot up these homes on 62nd and Osage. You would see a critical mass of outcry as it was happening. It is so confusing because this story is frankly insane, right? I mean, the more you learn about the details, the less sense it makes. Yeah, it would obviously set off some understandable outrage in 2013 or 2014 or 2015, but it is still sort of incomprehensible that it did not set off outrage in 1985, even if the media apparatus looked entirely different, right? I mean, it is the kind of thing that should have changed something, right? You would hope anyway, but nothing changed at all.
Gene, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Brooke.
Gene Demby is a correspondent for NPR's Code Switch.
Coming up, a football star quits the NFL over concussion fears. What role did the media play?
This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, a new study concluded that retired NFL players who've suffered from concussions, especially those who lost consciousness, are at a higher risk for later life cognitive decline. That news strengthens the links between on-field injuries and later neurological problems, which has been a courtroom evidentiary hurdle plaguing former players. But beyond the immediate legal liability, the NFL and the rest of the football industry are facing an existential threat as cases of chronic traumatic encephalopathy pile up. The NFL claims rule changes and equipment improvements have resulted in a sharp decline in concussions last season, but for some players, that's just not enough. Recently, the league was stunned when star San Francisco 49ers linebacker Chris Borland retired after his rookie season. Borland explains that his own research, not workplace education, led to his decision.
I began to look into the research. A high percentage of players suffer from early onset Alzheimer's or depression. A certain number of brains have been found to have a degenerative neurological disease, and accompanied with the anecdotes of players who'd done things from commit suicide to having memory loss in their 30s, that was enough for me to say thank you, but no thank you.
Every restaurant in the world, somewhere around the restrooms, has posters that say employees must wash their hands. Now, they kind of blend into the background, but they're there. And I wonder if, even in the background, players were kept aware of chronic brain encephalopathy with all of the really horrifying symptoms that you've described.
Yeah, there's a poster up in the locker room about tackling technique and avoiding injury, but I think players are sometimes willfully ignorant. Yeah, I understand there's something going on, but I'm focused on this week. If we can do a better job of informing young guys, I mean, even before high school, it's huge, because once you're a successful high school player, what's to stop you from going to college? If you're successful in college, of course you'll want to play in the NFL. And I even found myself thinking this past year, you know, I'm probably okay. I could probably play a second year. And then I'm sure I'd have that conversation in year two. And then if all of a sudden, if I'm fortunate enough to stay healthy, it's year six, and maybe it's too late for me to avoid some things down the road.
Tell me about denialism. You know, in the way that climate change denial has become a kind of a fixture of conservative politics, is there a constituency for head injury denialism?
Yeah, I think there is. There's a small separation between correlation and causation. And if you focus on that sliver of a gap between the two, yes, technically no one can prove that yet. But I think it's counterproductive to just deny that something's going on.
For many decades, before there was actual biological linkage between smoking and cancer, there was an endless amount of epidemiological evidence connecting the two. And yet the tobacco industry referred to a controversy surrounding tobacco. There was no controversy, and ultimately, of course, science caught up with the epidemiology. What about at the NFL? Is there anybody claiming, even at the league and the TV networks, that this is a controversial subject?
Well, I think a lot of people have made the analogy to big tobacco, but big football and proponents of football say that there's measures you can take to decrease the risks. And there are, but you know, they also made filtered cigarettes. So I don't know how much you can change football and keep it football, but individuals need to be informed and do what's right for them. I don't think you can look from the top down and expect drastic changes.
If you have sons, you going to let them play football ever?
I think I'd be more apt to actually let my son play if he weren't that talented. But the concern for me is getting into something where you have a great experience in high school. In colleges come calling and they're going to pay your tuition and imagine you'll have a great experience in college. It'd be really tough for anyone to say, hey, son, stop playing. And then the same is true of the next level.
And the hits add up.
Yeah.
And up and up and up.
Yeah. The violence is captivating. I understand that as much as anyone, but perhaps it goes too far.
Well, Chris, all the best for you, and thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate you having me.
Until 2 months ago, Chris Borland was a linebacker with the San Francisco 49ers. Now he's a civilian. Concussion fears first became big news back in 2007 when the New York Times ran a front-page story about former Philadelphia Eagles safety Andre Waters, whose suicide led to a posthumous diagnosis of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. The Waters story spiraled into a four-year-long project at the Times, spearheaded by reporter Alan Schwartz. But concerns about head injuries were on the radar, at least, even before then. In 1994, the NFL formed a committee to examine the effects of concussions. Schwartz says the findings from that report were outrageous.
Concussions in NFL players are no big deal. They can receive lots of them and be basically just fine. They can be knocked unconscious during a game and return to that same game almost immediately and be just fine. And by the way, it's possible this might even be applicable to high school players, they said. Well, of course, when Andre Waters killed himself, the NFL's reaction was, you know what, we've studied this and this is just anecdotal and we don't think it has any significance at all. A lot of people agreed with them.
Yeah, who agreed with them? Tell me about the media response.
I know that the Wall Street Journal came out with an article claiming that these players who were complaining of problems were probably just trying to set themselves up for a lawsuit, and specifically Ted Johnson, who was a player who was only 34, 35 years old, but he was having terrible memory and emotional problems. That certainly appeared to be the kind of thing that you get when you have mishandled concussions. You know, and the Journal and other places were very dismissive of what was clearly problematic and worth looking into and worth not dismissing.
But in short order, it seems to me that most of the mainstream media picked up on this story and pursued it and did not treat it dismissively, including ESPN, which is a business partner of the NFL to the tune of billions of dollars. They've done some pretty aggressive reporting, no?
Well, I think that that's true. There are moments where they really did show a great concern for this issue. Peter Keating from ESPN wrote an extraordinary article about the Jets and about their lead doctor, who also was the chairman of the NFL's concussion committee, just mishandling things all over the place. And Bob Lee from Outside the Lines did very nice treatments of, you know, the Andre Waters findings, the Ted Johnson situation, and other things.
Only a few years ago, TV announcers, upon, you know, a helmet-to-helmet hit that left some guy prostrate, would make insipid jokes about concussions. Now, when you see that unfold on the field, the same announcers gravely describe the concussion protocols, which is quite a transformation.
And I actually did a story on the language of concussions and how the language was changing, that, you know, dings were out, head injuries were in, and there was less whooping and hollering. And when a player got put back into a game improperly, when he obviously shouldn't have, you know, the announcers said so. What they realized is what we at the Times were always trying to do, which is what happens on Sundays happens the following Friday among youth players. And how you describe the events on these, you know, nationally televised games affects how people feel about these issues. And let's not make fun of it, because if you do, kids will make fun of it and they can get really hurt.
We just got done speaking with Chris Borland, who told us that while he was sort of vaguely aware of the concussion issue as a rookie in the NFL, when he started finally digging into the internet to find what had been reported, he was stunned, because till then his understanding of the issue was limited pretty much to a couple of news articles and a safety poster displayed somewhere in the locker room. Does that make sense to you?
No, it makes absolutely no sense. While, of course, I'm intrigued by Chris Borland's decision, which, by the way, is not unprecedented. Players have retired from the National Football League because they didn't want their heads kicked in the past. It just was in a different context. But I'm sorry, if you're a football player, and he's clearly a bright guy, and you don't know about this stuff, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for you. Now, the NFL should not lie to them, and I think it's fair to say that for a long time they did. But to claim that they are now, I just think it's missing an important point, which is there has to be some personal responsibility.
Alan, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Alan Schwartz is a reporter for the New York Times, where he covers drugs and society. He won the George Polk Award in sports reporting for articles exposing the long-term dangers of concussions.
On Tuesday, one of the authors of a headline-grabbing study published in December in the leading journal Science called for a retraction of his own work. The study claimed that a 20-minute face-to-face conversation with a gay canvasser could very often change someone's mind about gay marriage. So often, noted an editor at Science, that, quote, the magnitude of the shift for the person who answered the door was as large as the difference between attitudes in Georgia and Massachusetts. The study's astonishing findings were widely reported in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Vox, This American Life. Here's Ira Glass.
And the big surprise was, 6 months, 9 months, a year after the canvassers visited, the voters stayed changed. The researchers were so skeptical that this could be real that they did the entire study a second time. At huge cost, by the way, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And again, same result. Professor Green says he and his colleagues have read 900 papers and they haven't seen anything like this result. Anyone who's changed people's views and it lasted like this.
But when two graduate students, David Brookman and Joshua Kalla, tried to replicate the results, they found some worrisome red flags in the data. That prompted one of the study's co-authors, Donald Green, a Columbia University professor, to get the original data from his co-author, UCLA graduate student Michael LaCour. Green wanted to examine it, which he hadn't prior to publication, but LaCour didn't provide it. So Green asked Science to retract the study. Ivan Oransky is the co-founder of Retraction Watch, and he says those results should have been the first tip-off.
The idea that you could convince anyone of anything in this day and age is actually quite remarkable.
So what were the problems with the study that these graduate students found?
They actually were very taken with the study. One of them said, you know, I'm gay and this is something that I think about a lot and I wanted to believe this study. I also, he said, wanted to replicate it and then do the next step in the experiment. So he starts looking at the data. They're remarkable. The response rate.
Something like 90%?
Yeah, you don't get 90% in surveys. And just the magnitude of how they were able to shift, again, from Georgia to Massachusetts, it was pretty dramatic. And so that raised some red flags.
And then they found that the data were distributed over a pattern that could be easily generated by a computer program.
Correct. And this is how cheaters are caught in science. It looked funny. It looked too perfect. Then they dug further and said, well, let's look at how this was actually obtained. And when they called the survey company that had allegedly done the work, they said, we don't have anybody by that name here, and we don't do that kind of work.
I think it's pretty clear why Michael LaCour may have cooked this thing up. He was at the beginning of his career. He wanted to make a splash, and there isn't a way to make a bigger splash than to publish a paper in a journal like Science.
LaCour gave us the same statement that he gave lots of other news organizations and hasn't really responded to any questions in a substantive way. So I don't want to read his mind here, but if you look at the timeline, it's pretty clear that here's a guy who's out there looking for a job. And this would have been the time, December-ish, when he would have been out on the road applying for jobs, which he, according to the Princeton University website, did get at Princeton. But the pressure to publish, it's not far-fetched to say he was feeling that.
The motivation that isn't so clear to me is that of his co-author, Professor Green at Columbia. It strikes me that his failure to look at the original data and the excuse he gives for it just doesn't wash.
His rationale for not having looked at the data was that essentially, if you do research involving humans, which surveying them, particularly if you're trying to change their mind, is, then you need to get what's known as Institutional Review Board approval. And this is for good reason. This has been around about 40 years here in the U.S., protects human subjects. But someone had already given IRB approval for this, UCLA. Green could have easily sort of said to Columbia, here's what I want to do, is it okay? Or give me some sort of appointment at UCLA for 15 minutes so I can do that. Whatever it would be, there are lots of ways around that. But often what happens is people put their names on papers, and then when the proverbial hits the fan, they disown any knowledge of it. Well, I didn't do that part of the paper. And to be fair, Green is giving a rationale for why he didn't look at it, but he's the one who's actually sort of coming forward here and, I think, doing the right thing.
So let's talk about peer review. As you've noted, this is a volunteer, unpaid position. I think that situations like this make a very strong argument for actually paying peer reviewers, because anybody could have done what those graduate students did, which was to call up the place that generated the data, especially if it looked a little fishy.
If you talk to Science Journal editors about it, they say there's no way for us to have found that, no way for peer reviewers to have found that, but it rings a bit hollow because, as you point out, anyone could have called the place that allegedly did this survey. That probably would have been going beyond what is reasonable given that peer reviewers are unpaid, it's a volunteer activity, and they don't have that much time.
Well, in that case, they shouldn't be doing the peer reviewing.
So who should?
Pay them money and pay them by the hour.
I'm not against that. On the other hand, they would still need access to more information than they currently have, and they need more time to do it. We've seen a case, a study in Cell, came out about 2 years ago, cloning human embryonic stem cells. They missed all of these really problematic figures that were in the paper, which ended up having to get corrected. The people who caught that were not the peer reviewers, because the peer reviewers had said, at the request of the journal, we will do this in 24 hours. Now, imagine that. Those errors were found within days of the paper's publication.
Okay, now let's look at the journalists. We assume that once it's gone through the peer review process, we can trust it. You think, you know, not so fast.
What I tell my students at NYU, where I teach medical journalism, is you should keep a biostatistician in your back pocket. I think they're wonderful people. They tend to be somewhat lonely people. That's, of course, not fair. But having worked with them, it was so valuable because they could rip these studies apart, find out what was wrong, give me the questions to ask at the very least. Because in this case, really, no one raised very many red flags. That was actually somewhat amazing to me.
You think that the entire scientific slash journalism establishment had confirmation bias when it came to this study?
Yeah. When studies show something that we sort of believe is true or want to be true, which is probably even more pernicious than believe is true, we tend to sort of go along with it. This is why, to us, the argument really should be about post-publication peer review. Do some preliminary peer review, but let it out in the world and accept that just because it's published in Science or Nature or New England Journal of Medicine, it still probably has flaws that more eyeballs will find.
But it's already made its impact on the world, and it's much harder to make a counter-impact with a correction.
John Maddox was the editor-in-chief of Nature, and the reporter was trying to be a little provocative. He said, John, how much of what you publish every week in Nature, again, world's leading scientific journal, how much of it is wrong? And Maddox said, oh, that's easy, all of it. And what he meant was, over time, all of it would be proven wrong, with a couple exceptions. The bigger problem in science is not so much the fraud. It's this lack of reproducibility. But it is very much an epidemic in science right now. If you look at cancer studies, for example, as many as 90% of studies that are licensed into drug companies are not reproducible. That's the much bigger problem. If this gets everyone thinking about that, and if it makes a single reporter think twice about covering a study without any skepticism next time, we've accomplished something.
Ivan, thank you very much.
Thank you. Great. Always great to be here.
Ivan Oransky is Vice President and Global Editorial Director at MedPage Today, the co-founder of Retraction Watch, and a doctor who teaches medical journalism at NYU. Coming up, as the Internet of Things expands, are humans losing ground?
This is On the Media.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Once upon a time, here's how it worked. You bought a thing, maybe a thermostat or a bag of seed corn or a tractor, and you owned it. If you wanted to sell it used, you could sell it used. If you wanted to set it on fire, you set it on fire. If you broke it, you could fix it by any means at your disposal. You could do it because you owned it. That's so analog. Now that we're in the digital age and venturing deeper into the Internet of Things, some manufacturers assert that you don't actually own the things you buy. You own the hardware, but the software or other patented guts of the things, those you merely license. Among those manufacturers, John Deere, which says just because you've paid $25,000 for a tractor doesn't mean you have the right to repair it, because that would mean getting into their proprietary software, which is protected by a digital lock, which the Digital Millennium Copyright Act says you can't break. A bill introduced last month called the Breaking Down Barriers to Innovation Act of 2015 wants to make it easier for do-it-yourselfers, researchers, and others to seek an exemption from that rule. Kyle Weens is the CEO of iFixit, a community-based website of repair guides. He's also on the Digital Right to Repair Coalition's board of directors.
I have a friend here in San Luis Obispo who's a farmer, and he has a tractor that one day decided to stop working. And tractors these days have fancy computers in them, and it's got a display, and the display is showing an error, and it gives him a four-digit long error code. And he doesn't know what it is, so he calls up John Deere, and they say, oh, well, it's the sensor on your tractor tread that is malfunctioning. And he says, oh, okay, well, can I bypass the sensor? And they said, no, you have to replace the sensor. We'll overnight it out from the Midwest. It'll take 2 days to get there.
Your friend is not a man of leisure. He's a farmer, and he's got, like, farming to do.
Right. So he says, it's not acceptable for me not to run my tractor for the next 2 days. I have to bypass the sensor. And John Deere says, no, the software does not allow you to do that. there's a lot of repairs that farmers can do themselves. When I visited Dave, he was changing the oil in his tractor, all 8 gallons of it. But when it comes to the electronics, there are a lot of things that are locked down. Sometimes it's the legal restrictions that are making it difficult. Sometimes it's just a lack of information where manufacturers say, no, we're only giving the diagnostic software to our official technicians. And the manufacturers are taking advantage of this. They're using it to build out very profitable service networks.
John Deere has an interest in its code not being available to anybody for a hack for good purposes, like fixing your tractor sensor or stealing the proprietary software altogether, black marketing it and what have you. So it's not as though their interest in protecting their intellectual property is irrational, is it?
They're saying that, you know, you might pirate the software on the tractor. Well, the software, it comes with the tractor. So it's not like people are out there like selling pirated John Deere DVDs that they're going to give to other farmers. All the tractors come with the same equipment. One of the arguments that John Deere made against this is they said, look, these tractors can play music. Maybe people would be using their tractor to pirate the latest Taylor Swift album.
That sounds like lawyers looking for another bullet point to put in their court brief. But as to the larger issue, it's a thorny one.
This is a question of, you bought a thing. Who has the right to tell you what you can do with it? Can you fix it? Can you modify it? Can you paint it blue? And the problem is that this Digital Millennium Copyright Act that was passed back in 98 gives the control to the manufacturer. It takes control away from you, the owner of the product.
Apart from the question of just being able to repair something that belongs to you any way you see fit, do these prohibitive laws have any effect on us as owners or as nominal owners of various kinds of goods?
Well, you think about people that have been modifying cars, right? The thing that makes America great is that, you know, you can get a Mustang and you can soup it up. You can do whatever you want to modify it.
Congratulations, you've nailed it. That is what makes America great. You've isolated the thing.
It's the one thing.
To soup up
Absolutely.
Cars. That's it.
But that culture, I remember taking apart my first computer and like, wow, okay, that's how it works. That's what these different pieces are. And that's what inspired me to go into engineering.
Okay, so what's going to happen?
We have to decide to take back our rights. Minnesota and New York have both introduced what they call fair repair legislation, where they're working on saying, no, we have the right to be able to repair our things. We have the right to the information that we need to be able to fix these things. And then at the same level in Congress, there are three separate bills going right now to try to give people back the right to be able to tinker, modify, and repair their things.
Seems to me that this situation creates quite a market opportunity for somebody. And that is to build retro tractors that work with, you know, mechanics and carburation and non-digital technology so that farmers don't have to worry about hooking their machines up to computers when they break. All they have to do is replace the drive shaft or, you know, the master cylinder or whatever it is that's broken without fear of being in violation of anybody's license. Anybody doing that?
I think that's a reasonable idea, but I think that this is also something that can be addressed. I mean, there are a lot of benefits to modern technology. Adding GPS onto tractors allows farmers to be very precise. It allows them to get better yields out of their land. So I'm not necessarily in the technology is bad camp. The problem is the laws that govern the computer and the tractor were written by entertainment lawyers out of LA back in the 90s when they were trying to prevent DVD piracy. They weren't thinking about what would the best agricultural economy look like over the next century. So it's just time to update some of these laws. And I think there's an opportunity for Congress and state legislators to step in and do something about this.
Kyle, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Kyle Weens is CEO of iFixit. Now, on the subject of what you own and what you don't own, what if that thing is your name? Is that yours to do with as you please? The answer to that one, of course, is not necessarily. Consider the case of the Portland dance rock band The Slants. Asian American musicians who have taken their name from an ethnic slur and worn it with pride. But when they tried to register the trademark, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office said, "The Slants? No. So, the band sued. Last month, they lost their appeal at the Federal Circuit Court, but it turns out that the fight's not over yet. Simon Tam is bassist and founder of The Slants. Simon, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
All right, why did you choose the name The Slants for the band in the first place?
Honestly, it came from a conversation that I had with a good friend of mine when I first had the idea for starting an all-Asian band. So I said, you know, what's something that you think all Asians have in common? And without skipping a beat, they said slanted eyes. So I thought that's really interesting because not only does it sound like some kind of cool new wave band that Debbie Harry would be in, but it could also kind of be our slant on life, our perspective as Asian Americans, and at the same time, pay homage to decades of work by Asian American activists who've been kind of reclaiming slant in a positive, appropriated manner.
I'm curious why you need to have the slants be a registered trademark. What's the business purpose behind that?
In addition to the normal benefits like being able to protect your brand, merchandise, in the music industry, it's extremely important because there are licensing agencies and there are record labels who actually refuse to do business with acts who do not have a registered trademark or who do not have a name that can have a registered trademark.
But it turns out that the trademark office isn't exactly hip to the identity politics and the politics of language. They say the slants is a reference to your Asian roots, that it is a common slur, and therefore against the very explicit rules against disparagement in a trademark.
It shows that they have no actual connection to the Asian American community. We've actually done them a favor by doing independent national surveys and supplying like a 70-page Word document from one of the top linguistics professors in the country explaining the history of the term slant, how even in the 1930s and 40s, at its height of usage, it was never really used as a common slur. Nearly every single major dictionary publisher has actually removed the racial meaning from its list of possible definitions because it really isn't
used that way. Let me see if I understand this right. You're saying because the word slant is most commonly used to describe a diagonal or bias or any of the other dictionary definitions, that the trademark office's objections are irrelevant?
Yeah, they're kind of off base. They're basing their information off of an assumption, not actual usage.
Dude, how can you argue to the trademark office that it's an inoffensive word when its very offensiveness is what put you onto it to begin with?
I would actually use the words of the trademark office themselves. They said intention doesn't matter. The only thing they care about is how the respective market responds to it and whether or not the reference group is actually offended or disparaged by it. And survey after survey, they've shown that the Asian American community overwhelmingly embraces our use of the term.
What are you proposing, that there be an irony exemption to the disparagement rule?
I don't think it's the place of the trademark office to legislate the dictionary. I don't think they'd have the resources nor the competency to do so. For example, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, they got the green light. They have a registered trademark. But there was a t-shirt company that tried to put out t-shirts called Clearly Queer, and they got denied. It's the same word. What's the difference? One's going to be on a t-shirt and the other's going to be on a TV show. In terms of our particular trademark, the only person that's ever been denied for being disparaging to Asians is me, an actual Asian. And their rationale was that, well, we understand the term slant means so many different things, but they said that when you combine the word slant with our imagery, in other words, photographs of Asians on our website, which, you know, that would be us, that people would automatically associate it with the racial slur. If I fired everybody in my band or replaced them with white people, then I could get a registered trademark.
This is so confounding. Do you think that your situation was exacerbated by the fact that at approximately the same time you are applying for trademark protection for the slants, the Washington Redskins, who are not a Native American organization, are trying to protect their trademark?
With the most recent court order from the Federal Circuit, I think now we're kind of caught up in those particular politics because the recent order to vacate from the Federal Circuit basically said that we don't care about the nuances of your argument about cultural competency and procedural issues. The only thing they want to talk about is the constitutionality of the Lanham Act, the law that the trademark office is using against us. So in other words, what they're saying is, we just want to use your case to argue about this law, which is really another way of saying, if this law gets appealed, we get to blame this Asian band on the Washington Redskins getting their trademarks back and not the Redskins themselves or this court.
Are you concerned that you are going to win your case and then open a floodgate of slur-based trademarks that are an ongoing nightmare for ethnicities of every stripe?
People kind of have this concern. They're like, well, you don't want government backing these kind of groups. But the reality is, if that were the case, then why not support banned books? Or why not get rid of copyright protection for films or books or music that might contain slurs in them? If we're going to be a country of free speech, we actually do need to protect all forms of speech, even if we find them disagreeable.
Well, Simon, I understand you're about to go out on world tour, so Godspeed, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Simon Tam is the bassist and founder of the trademark outlaw, The Slants. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Kasia Mihailovic, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Ethan Cheel and Jenna Cagle, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.